Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here. I actually arrived in Australia last Wednesday and gave a talk at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, and then visited the tracking station, which of course is here near outside Tidmouth Bill outside Canberra. It's a very important communication link to the spacecraft that are deep in space. So I'd like to get over every year or two and tell everybody what's happening and all the excitement that's ahead. Mars and the search for life. It's not a new issue. In fact, science fiction has been talking about green Martians for I don't know how long. And it's also been a subject of scientific interest and controversy. At the turn of this century, ground-based astronomers, some at least they thought they saw evidence of intelligent life making canals and so on Mars. Of course, we know today that that isn't the case. But in terms of the space age exploration and search for life elsewhere, that really began, and let's see, touch screen to activate, slides on. There we go. That's Mars, as seen by a Viking spacecraft in 1976, when there was a mission called Viking, the intent purpose of which was to search for life on Mars. This is the Viking landing site. You can see the two scoop marks in the soil. Soil was picked up, put into three different experiments, all of which were designed to look for life. That is, in one case, some nutrients were added to see if anything grew. Nothing did. Another experiment looked to see if there was any residue, any leftover from decayed organic matter. There was nothing. None. In fact, the surface of Mars is sterile. It's sterilized by ultraviolet radiation from the sun, and the material on the surface is highly oxidizing, so that whatever organic materials might have been there have long since been burned, if you like, chemically into water and carbon dioxide. So the surface of Mars itself appears to be an unattractive place to look for life. And 22 years ago, this was a big disappointment, and the search for life elsewhere sort of went on hold for a while. It's interesting, though, that just a year after Viking landed on Mars, some oceanographers were in a small submarine beneath the ocean, where there are vents where hot superheated water is coming from the interior of the Earth, and they discovered prolific life growing down deep at the bottom of the ocean. The energy source was not sunlight, as we had all learned was the base of the food chain. In this case, the energy that was feeding this population was the chemical energy coming from the interior of the Earth. And these were life forms which were unlike any we had seen on Earth, a new kind of, in fact, neither a bacteria nor the kinds of cells which make up our bodies, for instance, neither of those, but in fact a third kind of life, but all related to the other two forms we become familiar with. Then in Antarctica, well, life was discovered in ice, where there was water mixed with the ice. Cores in the Earth down 1 or 2 kilometers, bringing up rock. If there was water in the rock, there's life. And so over the last two decades, what we've learned is on Earth, wherever there's water, there's life, liquid water. And so the search for life on Mars is now a search for where there was water and is there any place near the surface where there is water today. There would be no liquid water on the surface itself today because the temperature and pressure are such that it would boil away and be either in solid form or in gaseous form. So there was a lot of water on Mars at one time. These are huge canyons, and this is an ancient ocean basin that you can see here. Huge canyons carved by massive floods. These canyons are typically measured in kilometers in width, not in meters. Huge canyon systems. Lots of water. Here is what certainly looks like a dry lake bed, where there was a standing pool of water for a long time, and the deposits which are then left behind as the water evaporated. A lot of water at one time. It's believed that today there may well be, in fact there likely is, a lot of water underground. Of course, near the surface it will be frozen because it's so cold on Mars, but like on Earth, you drill down deep enough, it becomes warmer and it should be liquid. And the real question is, are there any spots on Mars which were thermally active, like Rotorua in New Zealand or Yellowstone National Park in the United States, where thermal volcanic heat is bringing hot water right up next to the surface in a place where life could have been quite abundant at one time. Well, those are the sorts of questions we're now asking. And we're now on a program of sending two missions to Mars every time we can, an orbiter and a lander. And that every time we can means every 26 months when the orbits of Mars and Earth line up. The first such opportunity was in 1996. We sent a lander, Mars Pathfinder, and an orbiter, Mars Global Surveyor. Pathfinder landed last summer, summer of 97, bouncing on airbags. The airbags would be slightly taller than the front of this room, and carrying inside the landing system, which you can see here, four-sided. Here's one of the four panels. Here are the airbags now tucked up underneath. These rolls are the ramps, which the rover can roll down in order to get off and use its small spectrometer to measure what the rocks are made of. Here is Sojourner. This is that sensor system on the front up against this rock. This rock is about 75 centimeters high, so it gives you some sense of scale. This small sensor system could measure the elemental composition, that is, how much carbon, how much silicon, how much iron was in the rock. And as is often the case, the first time you make a measurement, you're surprised. We thought these rocks would be like the lava flows in Hawaii, basaltic material. It turns out they're not. They are much more processed than that. That is, the material, rocky material, has been cycled several times so that it's enriched in silicates, lighter silicates. So this tells us that Mars, like Earth, has had a more complex geologic history, more complex than we imagined before we landed with this little rover. That was last summer, summer of 97. As I said, we also launched a companion orbiting spacecraft, which is now in orbit around Mars. It's called Mars Global Surveyor. You can see the data as it comes down on our homepage, www.jpl.nasa.gov. As this spacecraft, which is now in a very elliptical orbit, we're diving down into the atmosphere, taking energy out of the orbit so it eventually will become circular, so that we'll get the same kind of resolution all the way around the planet. We arrive in a circular orbit in March, and then we start mapping. And to show you, though, with some of the surprises which are ahead, we have taken a few images even as we're waiting for to get to the circular orbit. Here is one of those images, a sinuous canyon. And very tantalizing is now, with this resolution, one can begin to see what certainly looks like an ancient stream bed at the bottom of that canyon, that there was actually running water on Mars at one time. And an even more intriguing thing is this. This is a large bowl, an impact crater created by something hitting Mars, making this deep crater. This is the rim of the crater, and you can see the crater wall here. And the interesting thing is this material that seems to be seeping out of the walls of this crater. And the other interesting thing is the black material, which certainly looks like it's a pond at the base of the crater. Now, this can't be liquid water. As I said, liquid water can't exist on Mars today. It could be frozen water. This is down near, not too far from the South Pole. But there are a lot of puzzles about this image, because we would not have expected liquid water to be coming out of the walls of a crater so near the surface, where we think it's quite cold. That's a bit of a surprise. So we really don't understand how to interpret this image, but it's just a sample of the surprises which are ahead as we begin to systematically map the entire surface of Mars with this kind of resolution. We even have the capability for selected pieces of Mars to see things as small as a meter and a half on the surface of Mars, so that those interesting hot spots or old hot spots or possible lakes, frozen lakes like this, we'll be able to zoom in on with even more resolution as we begin to look for the interesting places to send our missions. We can go back every 2 years. These two are there. Pathfinder's there. Global Surveyor's there. That was 96 launch. We have two more coming up. Every 2 years, we're launching another orbiter this December, and in January, the next lander. The next lander will land down near the South Pole. This is a polar ice cap, not water ice, but solid dry ice, solid carbon dioxide. This region in the southern winter will be completely covered out down to that distance. You can barely see the mark, but about down to there. So we're going to land well within the region on Mars, which has this annual cycle of being buried and then uncovered with carbon dioxide snow. This particular lander is designed to... Can we get it? There we go. Is designed to pick up some soil, but this time we're not looking for organic material. We know we aren't going to find any, or at least we don't expect to find any because of these sterilizing effects. What we're looking for is water, water ice in particular. So we have instruments on the lander this time which can heat the soil, drive out, melt the ice, and drive out the water so we can begin the search for where is the water on Mars today. This lander lands on Mars in November of next year, November of 99. Then, further on, every 2 years, this is the current architecture. And we'll, as we learn things, of course, the architecture could change, but we would send another orbiter with another set of instruments to help us better understand the surface. If we have the right kind of spectrometers, we might be able to tell what that material is in the bottom of that crater, for instance. In 01, we'll send essentially a duplicate of the Sojourner rover. In 03, we have a more sophisticated rover. It'll be about three times as large as Sojourner. It will have on it the instruments which will allow us to identify rocks which have the geologic history that's most compatible with having possibility of life having evolved. Not that there's life in the rock today, but there may be some residue then. So this little rover will be able to send us back science data on the various rocks. When we find one that's interesting, it will be able to take a small core sample, and it can do that for about 50 rocks. It will then bring those 50 back to the lander, which will have on it a small Mars ascent vehicle, which will launch those pieces of rock up into orbit around Mars, waiting for a mission in 05 to capture them and return. In 05, we'll send the same rover, same kind of rover, to a different interesting spot. It will pick another 50 rocks. We'll launch them back into Mars orbit, and then the orbiting spacecraft that will have been launched in 05 will arrive. We'll go into orbit around Mars. We'll rendezvous with either or both of these samples, retrieve them, and bring them back to Earth, and return to Earth in 2008, 10 years from now. Now, we don't know how to do all that today. We don't have this little launch vehicle. We have to invent it. We don't have this rover with the capability I've talked about. We have to invent it, but we do have a few years ahead in order to do that. Then, of course, one could just repeat this cycle, more rovers, and then another sample return mission 3 years later. We don't know exactly what we're going to do because we will be learning along the way. The orbiting spacecraft will tell us the interesting sites. The rover itself will tell us about the interesting rocks, and I expect that we will learn, and as we learn, we may change some of our plans. But we are now on a program which will allow us to learn in a very rapid fashion as we begin a serious search for life on Mars. But Mars is not the only place that we're thinking about. Bob Mitchell was here, I guess, just earlier this afternoon talking about the Galileo mission. This is a Voyager image of Jupiter. This is the Great Red Spot, a huge hurricane-like storm system. This is a smaller storm system, the white spot. And as I imagine Bob might have told you, the size of the system is such that that little storm is about the size of the Earth. So these are giant planets. That means that these two moons are not as small as they seem. They're both about as large as our moon. Europa, Io with the 8 active volcanoes, and Europa, which has this very smooth, icy surface. This is a Voyager image from 1979. By eye, this would look almost snow white, but there are slight colorations and streaks that you can see here. With Voyager, we were able to show that those streaks basically are markings on the surface, basically, and not huge mountain chains. There are no mountains and no valleys on this world. Here's a Galileo image, false color, to emphasize the fact that these cracks in the ice, which have formed, and then material comes from inside underneath the ice and deposits on the surface, and this false color just enhances the slight color differences which are there. You can see things maybe a kilometer or so across in this image. If we look even more closely with Galileo, you can see these ancient ridge systems, some of them quite recent, others which are much more subdued and older, a very patterned crisscross surface, except up here where you can see the pattern is broken down. That's referred to as chaos terrain because it looks chaotic. And if you look at it even more closely, you'll see the patterns are there, but they're broken up into these small blocks, just like icebergs in the Arctic Ocean when the ice pack is breaking up. Evidently, these pieces of the surface, which used to be closely connected together, have migrated, moved around on the surface of Europa, certainly indicating that the ice must have been, at that time, must have been quite soft. Whether it was exposed water or not, no one knows, and we don't know how deep down the solid ice goes before it becomes mushy, if not, in fact, a liquid water ocean. That's one of the questions we have, because it's in the oceans on Earth that life evolved, and if Europa indeed has liquid water, even if it's just mixed with ice, that doesn't matter. In Europa, when you have water mixed with ice, there's life that thrives at essentially 0 degrees centigrade. It would be surprising that if there is such an environment here, if life had not evolved. The challenge we have is how do we find it? So we're thinking about sending a mission back to Europa, but currently Galileo, as Mitchell told you, is in orbit around Jupiter and flies by Europa only every 2 months and can image like this only for a little tiny bit of Europa as it flies by. We want to go into orbit around Europa itself, a very challenging thing to do, and therefore map with radar and with imaging and with a laser altimeter so we can measure the shape of Europa very accurately, try to determine how thick that ice is, and then decide what the next step would be to get down onto that icy surface and perhaps through it so that we could begin to explore this world for the possibility that life evolved there. Further out, we don't expect any liquid water, but there is an interesting part of the story in further out in the solar system. This is Saturn, 10 times as far from the Sun as the Earth. Jupiter is 5. Saturn, the sunlight's only 1% of what it is here. It's very cold at Saturn, minus 170 centigrade or something like that. But there is a world out there called Titan, which is the size of the planet Mercury, but it's a moon of Saturn. Unlike Mercury, which has no real atmosphere, has a very faint, tenuous atmosphere, Titan has a substantial atmosphere, 60% higher pressure than here on Earth, so it's even higher pressure than here, 80% nitrogen, just like here on Earth, but no oxygen. Here on Earth, oxygen was created by microorganisms, by life. If life, those microorganisms were to disappear, so would the oxygen. No oxygen on Titan, no life of that sort, but there is methane, natural gas, and the action of sunlight in that atmosphere. Here on Earth, sunlight creates smog. It creates the oxides of nitrogen, sulfur dioxide. It creates ozone, all the things you hear about in terms of air pollution. Air pollution there is not oxides. There's no oxygen. The air pollution there is organic molecules being made in the atmosphere. This is a fuzzy image, not because our camera could not take a sharp image, but because we are looking at a haze layer made of organic molecules, actually polymers of organic material, which have been created in the atmosphere and are so abundant we can't see through the haze layer. This material is raining down on the surface of Mars, of Titan, just as snow falls in our polar caps. Here, it's not icy snowfall, but in fact organic polymers, which are coating the surface of Titan. In fact, one of the organic materials made is ethane, which is a liquid at the temperature and pressure of the surface of Mars. And there are some predictions that we will find lakes of liquid hydrocarbons, liquid organic materials, on this bizarre world. Now, this is the Cassini mission. As you can see from the person down here, it's a very large mission. Total mass, when it was fueled up, was 6,000 kilograms. This is the radio antenna that transmits back to Earth. This is the Huygens probe built by the European Space Agency, which is designed to drop into that atmosphere. So in about at the end of 2004, we will drop this probe into the atmosphere of Titan. It is instrumented to measure the organic compounds that are being made there. It'll measure temperature, pressure. It'll look at the cloud levels. It will have an imaging system so we can look at the surface. And the orbiting spacecraft, which will remain in orbit around Saturn, will be able to use radar to map the surface so that we can begin to explore this world. The organic chemistry that's occurring there today is in many ways thought to be similar to that which occurred in the Earth's atmosphere before life evolved and oxygen became the important secondary species. So the nature has provided us, if you like, with a laboratory where we can try to understand what some of the processes might have been that contributed to the organic material that was available in the oceans out of which life evolved. That's what Titan's all about. And I'm sure that after this landing in 2004, that we're going to want to find ways to get back to Titan and actually be able to move around and explore the surface and not just drop at one point down into the atmosphere. Another key part of the story may well be comets. Now, comets are the leftover from when the solar system formed. Uranus and Neptune are made of comets. Many of the comets ended up inside the giant outer planets. Some of them, though, were scattered by those planets out far from the sun and are loosely orbiting the sun and occasionally will come in. They're mainly water ice, and until 15 years ago, we thought they would be snow white, because after all, that's what water ice is. But Giotto spacecraft flew by in 1986, flew by Halley, and by that time we realized that comets, like so many icy objects in the outer solar system, are covered with charcoal black material. In fact, the surface of Halley is black, not white. It's covered with some kind of organic compounds from somewhere. The question is, what is the organic material coating these comets? Where did it come from? And what did it contribute to the oceans here on Earth and on Mars and Venus before life evolved? What role did this material have in the origin of life here on Earth and possibly elsewhere? Well, the only way we can answer those questions is to have a sample of the comet. We can't answer it by just looking at it remotely. The challenge, though, is that in order to get a sample of the comet, you have to fly through the dust, and you capture the dust as you fly through. You're flying through at about a speed of over 10,000 kilometers per hour. And you can probably imagine if you would stick out a paddle or a basket to catch the dust, what would happen? The dust would evaporate. It would be gone. So we can't do that. What we've done instead is we're going to stick out a paddle made of this stuff right here. This is called aerogel. And the best analogy I have for this is cotton candy. Now, I don't know if you call it cotton candy here in Australia or not. It's made out of sugar, but it's basically spun out, so it's... fairy floss, right. That's fairy floss, except it's made out of silicate, out of sand instead of sugar. But it's the same idea. We can make this stuff so thin that it has the density of air. In fact, the material we're going to use is about 6 times denser than that. And these little dust particles, because it's so low density, they will hit this material and just bury themselves in there without being damaged at all. And then here they are. You have to protect the spacecraft itself, of course, so we have these special bumpers in front to make sure the particles damage the spacecraft. We stick this aerogel out in the stream, let this dust bury itself in it, we pull it back in, and return it to Earth. Now, this is not a mission we're thinking about doing. This mission is going to be launched next January. It's built. It's ready to go. We're going to launch it in January, and it will return to Earth in January of 2006 with a first sample of the comet dust, which is this organic material. It's really quite remarkable when you think we're going to have these samples to analyze. Well, anyway, that's just a sampling of some of the things we're doing to begin to attack this question: did life evolve elsewhere? What is the origin of life here on Earth? Did it evolve elsewhere in the solar system? And eventually, of course, are there other solar systems where life might have evolved? Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.